Okay, I'm just going to yank it. I'm going to do two things. I'm going to assume that we are going to take a little bit more time, and I'm going to switch to a somewhat shorter version of my talk. So let me go ahead and pull that up. I came prepared. What can I say? I've also got another flash drive and a CD. What can I say? Okay, so anyhow, I will try to get us out a little bit late, but hopefully not any later than anybody else. So, Sarah set the stage well. I have to tell you that we know each other from way back, but we did not collaborate. We're not in cahoots on this. You know the old saying, great minds think alike. That's what we'll have to settle with. Okay, well, I have to assume, since there's a good number of you here, that by the title I gave, you came to see a crash. And I'll try not to disappoint you. You know, car wrecks, that kind of thing. Okay, here's my beginning point, and you've already heard some thinking about this. My beginning point is that we, as Christians, but also as a society at large, make certain assumptions about the human soul, and that in some cases these assumptions are not justified. In some cases they may even be inappropriate assumptions. The first one that I've got here, Sarah's already taken a lot of flack for this idea, so hopefully some of that's deflected, but it certainly is a potentially controversial assumption to take a pot shot at. But I'm going to try to defend my reasoning in doing so. The next two are more clearly assumptions that are invalid. These are assumptions that smack of almost a Gnostic heresy kind of approach where the spiritual is good and the material is bad. But I would posit that many people think this way about the soul versus the material body, and I would posit that it's an inaccurate assumption based on some of the baggage from the Greek philosophy that Sarah has talked about. So this is where I'm going to go in a nutshell. I got a lot packed into this. This turned into to be a bigger topic than I had anticipated, but I sure enjoyed working through it, and I hope that we'll all gain something from the presentation. So five models of personhood. I'm going to go over some of the same ground that Ted and Sarah already talked about. I'll introduce some more current theories, some theological insights, very brief here, just talking about a little bit of the biblical anthropology, some of which has already been covered. Biological insights, mostly focusing on development, but a couple of snapshots of other things. And then I'm going to present a model that I consider a pedagogical model. I think this could be of use for us as we teach and learn and simply investigate questions of the human soul. A model of developing homonization, and then some applications. And those applications will relate specifically to the three assumptions. Okay, here are those five, or the first three of the five models. The next two are on the next slide. These are all past historical views of the soul, but they certainly are influential in our current conception. The first, Neoplatonism, as put forward by St. Augustine. Augustine, from what I read, was very enamored of Platonic thought. And in fact, there are some commentators on Augustine who even assume that when he wrote The City of God, he was still somewhere between a Neoplatonist in the full sense of the word and a Christian, that he hadn't even really made that full conversion. Neoplatonism, as taught by Augustine, basically adopts the Platonic view of the soul as two distinct substances, but replaces two of Plato's key concepts about the soul with ideas that are much more harmonious with the Christian view. That is, Plato would have said that the soul is eternal. Augustine says it's immortal. Plato would have said that the soul is trapped within the body. Augustine says that the soul uses the body. Compound dualism, as taught by Aquinas, is based on some of Aristotle's views, and you already heard about some of these. Here, the soul, as Sarah suggested, is not so much the rational guiding person, but it's the form of the person. It is what directs the development, and then later the rational soul arrives and becomes a guiding force for the person's intellect and emotions. So, as already suggested, Aquinas believed that there were three kinds of souls: vegetative first, then sensitive, and then finally the rational soul. You've already heard that men get their rational souls at 40 days, women at 90 days. I don't think it's because women are slow. I just think it's because they're so much more darn complex. I mean, I'm a married guy. I know this.
I want to know if men lose their soul.
Wouldn't be surprised. The soul and the body, in Augustine's view, are integrally related. Now, it's interesting to me that much of Catholic theology still follows Aquinas, although obviously Catholic theology doesn't currently hold delayed ensoulment, but Catholic theology has adapted to some of the biological insights that we now have.
Just a point of clarification.
Yes?
The Catholic Church has not resolved the question.
No, no, it's not resolved. I guess the Encyclium Vitae suggests that we should err on the side of caution, assuming that that could be the time of ensoulment.
Abortion has been 2,000 years prescribed because it destroys a developing human being. Whether that developing human being has a soul or not yet.
Okay.
Question.
Substance dualism, René Descartes. We've already heard a little bit about Descartes' theories. I would posit that Descartes sees the soul as the real person. His dictum, cogito ergo sum, I'm thinking, therefore I am, he is very much relating the soul to who the person is. Okay, now we move to two models that arose in the 20th century or still being worked out in the 21st century. I'm using just a couple of thinkers who exemplify these models. Emergent dualism, William Hasker. In emergent dualism, the mind or the soul is a spiritual substance, at least according to Hasker, but it's a spiritual substance that emerges from the complexity of the material body. So there's something new there when material entities reach a certain level of complexity. This is a very controversial assumption in terms of modern physics, etc., but there are a number of people that hold to this kind of view of the development of some kind of essence of personhood arising out of the complexity of the material body. The next view, and I can just give snapshots here, physical monism, as exemplified by Murphy and O'Connor. I'm using both of these thinkers because I think Murphy has ideas that set the stage, but I think she lacks a little bit of something that O'Connor contributes. In this view, the human person is comprised of a material body. And by the way, all the thinkers noted here are Christian individuals. The human person is fully comprised of the material body, and so the material is what you've got. Now, Murphy specifically chooses to talk about physicalist monism rather than materialist monism because she says, I want to avoid the implications that go with the term materialism. I believe that God is involved here, but the human body is really all there is in her view. What makes us unique is, in her view, defined as the higher attributes, the higher capacities of human being that are in part explainable by brain function. Murphy also sees the influence of the environment, our relationship with one another, our relationship with God is very important. What O'Connor brings to this position is he basically agrees with Murphy, but he also posits that there is a non-physical, but also non-spiritual emergent property that functions in the same way as Hasker's spiritual emergent essence. So there you've got just a quick overview of those five options. This by no means encompasses all the possibilities, but I think they represent some good ones that we can at least base some further thinking on. Okay, in this slide, you have to excuse my sort of gross minimalizing of these concepts. What I've tried to do is I've tried to put these five models down one side and the three options across the top, origin of the soul or the person, that is the timing of the beginning of the human person, the status, good versus bad as far as spiritual versus material, and then the identity, what is the real person in each of these views. You'll also have to excuse my crude use of color here, which certainly betrays my preferences. Red would be stop, green would be go, and yellow's caution. And what you see is that basically what I see is some of these unjustified assumptions come to us essentially from Neoplatonism and from Cartesian dualism. And so the idea that the soul is present at the beginning is in many ways supported by Neoplatonism. I don't really have time to go into why I've made that orange instead of red, but Augustine never, as I understand it, came down exactly on when he thought the soul was present. Aquinas obviously held to delayed homonization, and so he is indicated across the board here in green. René Descartes did not, as far as I'm aware, specifically state a time at which the soul was present, but I think his model is highly compatible with immediate ensoulment, and certainly those who followed Descartes would have based a lot of their thinking on that assumption. Similar with the identity of the person, Neoplatonism and Cartesian dualism certainly seem to me to suggest that the soul is the real person. Now, this middle category, the status, I don't think any of these models outright teach that the soul is somehow better than the body, but I think because of certain associations historically, those assumptions have been derived from these models by followers of those models. So the fact that Neoplatonism has the Greek associations that it does may have led some Christians to adopt a somewhat dualistic good versus not good perspective on soul versus body. Certainly this is the kind of relationship that you see in the Gnostic heresy, where a full-fledged heresy adopted the view that the soul is better than the body. Cartesian dualism, for other reasons, seems to elevate the thinking part of the human being as opposed to the material part. Okay, from here, I just want to look a little bit at some of the other considerations. I don't have nearly enough time to really do justice to the biblical anthropology, but I list these terms simply to illustrate the fact that there's a wide variety in the way that these terms were used in the Old Testament. And now the Old Testament and the New Testament certainly are a different type of situation. The Old Testament virtually never speaks of the afterlife, and when it does, it speaks in the mysterious terms of Sheol, and it sees the afterlife as something of a dark world. But the Old Testament, in the words of Cooper, who himself is a dualist, the Old Testament is strictly this worldly. It really focuses on the relationships in this world. So nephesh, the word we translate as soul, is seen as something like our concept of the soul, but it also refers to the physical in some cases, the neck, the throat, or even the stomach. Animals have a nephesh. And more often than not in the Old Testament, when you see the term nephesh, it really refers to the person, him or herself. So this is a term that can be equated simply to myself or the individual. Similar with ruach, the word we translate as spirit originally meant wind or breath. Again, animals have a ruach. And Cooper sees it more as a vital force or an energy, not an immaterial substance. These other three refer to bodily parts, but the bodily parts in Hebrew anthropology all were also associated with emotion and rationality and decision-making. So my essential assumption here is that in the Old Testament, these terms were very interchangeable, and they really just reflected on the person, him or herself. Now, there were changes in the New Testament, and these changes were in many ways established on the kinds of developments that occurred during the intertestamental period. So over the time of the intertestament, there was quite a bit of development of thinking about the afterlife. And so essentially many of the words were just translated into Greek. The word psyche, which is the translation for nephesh or the soul. The word pneuma, which is the translation for the ruach or the spirit. During the intertestamental period also came to have the meaning of the disincarnate person or the person in the afterlife. So this is where we get our strong tie between soul and spirit as the immaterial part of the person. Okay, turning to biology and some insights that we can get from biology, here's where we can deal with this idea of twinning. Some of you are obviously familiar with this, some of you may never have thought of this, but the idea is that there are some twins, a very small number of pregnancies develop this way, but some twins, as evidenced by identical twins in our midst every day, that develop from a single embryo. So one sperm fertilizes one egg. Some point along the way, up to about 14 or 15 days, it's possible for that embryo to split and give rise to two human individuals. This has been, ever since about 1970, a test case for the question of immediate ensoulment. If the soul is present at the moment of fertilization, what do we say about these two people that are derived from one zygote? Do they share a soul? Are they cloned souls, essentially? Or does the original soul die and then a new soul or two new souls take its place? This is a common view among folks that hold to immediate ensoulment. The model that I found most interesting was co-location of souls proposed by Koch Hirschenov. So Koch Hirschenov says that what happens is God knows ahead of time which embryos are going to twin, and so he co-locates two souls. There are actually two people present in that zygote, even though it's just a single zygote. Now, Koch Hirschenov deals with some philosophical arguments to this proposition, but she doesn't deal with the argument that I think is the most significant, which is that, to me, this makes God into a micromanager. It seems to smack of the kind of statement that Isaac Newton made when he talked about the universe occasionally needing a little bit of a push from God to keep the planets going. You know, we later determined that that wasn't the case at all, and that became something of a sore spot for Isaac Newton. Okay, so this is one problem. Another problem that was also alluded to in the audience was this idea of embryo fusion. We now know, since about the 1960s, that there are some people, not very many, but there are some people in the general population who are not derived from a single embryo, but rather from two. So fraternal twins, each zygote produced by a separate fertilization event, have melded within the uterus, a very unusual circumstance, but it happens. People go in for a blood transfusion, and they get typed, and they find that, wow, you've got two blood types. How very strange. And then a genetic analysis shows that all of their cells are derived from two different types of cells. I had a friend in high school who may have been a genetic chimera. He had two different colored eyes. This is sometimes the tip-off that a person is formed from two embryos. What do we say about a person like that? How many souls are there? Do we have soul schizophrenia in this case? And by the way, most of these people are perfectly normal psychologically. Now, you do have some cases where genetic chimerism leads to hermaphroditism, and I would suspect that those people have some identity problems. But most people that are genetic chimeras seem to be perfectly normal psychologically. Do the two souls fuse? Does one soul die or dissipate to make room for the other? To me, none of these options seems very satisfactory if soul is equal to person. So this, to me, seems to present a bit of a challenge to that idea. Okay, moving on, and just snapshots here, but other kinds of studies from biology, studies of animal consciousness, studies of brain and consciousness, basically all I want to say is what's listed up here on the slide, and that is that animals, some animals, certainly do evince signs of consciousness, not just signs of consciousness, you just basically can't deny that there's consciousness there, which is what René Descartes did. René Descartes said that animals are just biological robots. And I guess René Descartes didn't have a dog, but I think we all can see with current studies on chimps, for example, that there's a lot of mental processing, even self-reflection going on in those kinds of animals. And the kinds of consciousness that some of these higher animals have and the kinds of brain structures and functions that they have are not distinctly different from human consciousness, human brain structure function. There's a difference in magnitude, but not a difference in type. So I would posit that this kind of observation is completely compatible with human consciousness being very much like animal consciousness. And so any model that posits that the soul is the locus of consciousness suffers under these observations. Similar kind of conclusions about brain and mind or consciousness. We know that things that affect the brain affect the consciousness. I won't belabor this, but brain tumors, for example, can totally change a person's personality. So there's a direct one-to-one correlation. Okay, I've crammed a lot in here, and I don't have all of my evidence in this talk, but from this, I want to suggest what I call this model of developing hominization, and I mention again that I think of this as a pedagogical model, not a doctrinal model, so it's one that we can hold up and we can use to think about, do these assertions make sense? Can we make certain assumptions about the soul? Are other assumptions perhaps less tenable? So my first assumption here on this model is that humans are different from other animals. We have a much more advanced type of consciousness. We have a different kind of ability to love, relate to others, and to God. This, in my view, although I wouldn't be so bold as to say I've figured it out, but these are the kinds of things that constitute the image of God, in my view, is our higher capacity to simply act as humans and to do the kinds of things that God calls us to do. Now, I'm using this very imprecise word essence here simply because I had a long strung out phrase that wasn't very compatible with a slide demonstration. So I use this term essence here as shorthand for this thing that makes us human. I would say that I'm not comfortable at this point denying that the essence that makes us human is spiritual. But on the other hand, I'm not comfortable asserting that it absolutely is. So I'm just going to sit right here on the fence, and I'm going to say that this essence that enables these attributes may be material or immaterial, physical or spiritual. And I'm sorry if you don't care for that, but that's where I sit. I am making a little bit stronger and more contentious assertion that I don't really think the data are consistent with the view that this essence is present, at least in its complete form. It may be present in some germ, but not in its complete form at fertilization. I think this essence interacts in such a way with the material body that really there is only a functional, or there is only a condition of functional unity. The two are need each other in order to function perfectly. And then finally, more of a moral and ethical theological point than a scientific point, this essence should not be considered somehow better or purer than the rest of the person and should not be considered to constitute the real person. Okay, my whole point here was really to get to this where I suggest that our working assumptions often lead us into wrong conclusions. And so I've looked at three particular test cases for these three assumptions, and I want to just touch on those very briefly in the next few minutes. So regarding the initiation of personhood, obviously this has huge impact on our concept of the sanctity of life, so I don't want to ignore that. We'll take a few minutes and look at that. Regarding the status of the material body, I think that it can certainly be claimed that this darker view of the material body has led to asceticism in an overly ascetic form, so where you draw the line between spiritual disciplines and pathology is hard to say, but I think some asceticism clearly was pathological, and I think it was also related to a marginalization of women in the church, and I'll show you a little bit of information on that. And then regarding the identity of the person, I think who we consider to be the real person has a very significant impact on what we consider to be the mission of the church. Is it just evangelization, or is it meeting the needs of other people and social responsibility? Okay, we cannot discount the fact that the argument that life begins at conception is a very strong argument. There's data to show that what we think about life beginning at conception impacts the choices we make, especially women who believe life begins at conception are faced with the question, should I have an abortion? So there's a strong correlation there that helps to preserve that link for the sanctity of life argument. On the other hand, I think you can make an equally strong argument from God's good intention. So I started out, human intention may be some of our problems, misplaced good intentions of humans. But I think God has a good intention for each embryo, and he is the one who ultimately is in charge of the fate of that embryo. Now, granted, some of those embryos never come to fruition, never become human beings, but he is the one that should have ultimate authority over the destiny of those embryos. And so I think if we take it upon ourselves to interpose ourselves against God's goodwill for those embryos, we're just as culpable of doing something heinous as if we destroy a human life. That would be my take. In addition to that, I think if we can use this kind of an argument as compared to the argument for the presence of a spiritual soul at the moment of fertilization, it may be possible that we can make broader connections that will help to promote a sanctity of life ethic across a broader community. There may be folks who would take issue with the idea of ensoulment. There are folks who would take issue with the idea of ensoulment at fertilization who would not take issue with the fact that we shouldn't meddle with God's good intentions. I think even an atheist or an agnostic can see, if nothing else, more rationale in this argument if he or she doesn't believe in the immaterial soul. A lot more I could say there, but time is a constraint. Asceticism and marginalization. Okay, if you've seen anything on Tertullian and his view of women, you've seen this quote. It certainly is not completely representative, but Tertullian and other church fathers said lots of things like this about women. And I think it was motivated by good intentions on some count. That is, we don't want people falling into promiscuity and sexual sin, but on the other hand, it takes a very dim view of women, and I think that's done a lot of injustice throughout the centuries. I don't have time to make the complete case, but there is a developing scholarship out there that suggests that in the 20th century, some of the legacy of this misogynistic perspective on women is the modern disease of anorexia nervosa. Not all women who suffer from this would have this kind of dualistic perspective, but there are statistics that show that some women, especially out of some fundamentalist movements, who have a high sense of the need for, I don't know, bodily control because of spiritual concepts, are more prone to suffer this disease. I had a quote that I would have read if there were more time that directly links one woman's thinking about her anorexia with a view of the disembodied soul being the real essence of the human person. And then finally, this idea of evangelism and social responsibility. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Lausanne Conference in 1974 in Switzerland. This has been described as a landmark conference in the evangelical movement. And among the landmark developments that came out of the Lausanne Conference was the Lausanne Compact that said things as controversial as this. We affirm that evangelism and socio-political involvement are both part of our Christian duty. Now, that didn't rock anybody's socks in here, did it? But back in 1974, those would have been considered fighting words by some evangelicals. What do you mean we should also focus on social responsibility? There had been a backlash against higher criticism and against liberal theology, which was also pushing the social gospel. And so for many years, evangelicals essentially disavowed the significance of social responsibility. Now, certainly there were social, political kinds of influences there, but some people see a link between this disavowalment for social responsibility and a dualistic view of the human person. Rene Padilla, for example, who's been very involved in what's called holistic mission, says that the reduction of the Christian mission to a message of otherworldly salvation grows out of a misunderstanding of God's purpose and the nature of human beings. In the final analysis, this is a reduction related to ideas taken from Greek philosophy, not from Scripture. Okay, just some snapshots. Final considerations I want to leave you with. The model I've presented shouldn't be considered dogmatic. Please don't go out and start preaching this as the message according to Rod. The purpose is to stimulate teaching, learning, deeper consideration on the meaning of personhood. And the proposition that immediate ensoulment is incorrect could prove very contentious if misused. So remember some of my favorite words of Augustine in Essentials Unity and Non-Essentials Liberty, in all things charity, please. And then finally, the proposition that both spirit and matter are good and that the whole person needs salvation seems self-evident to most of us, I think. But remember, history shows that the heart of man is deceitful above all things. So let's keep working on it. Don't really have time for questions, but let me let you ask them. If you want to leave, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
The conception hasn't been placed yet as what our
is. I wish I hadn't used the moment of conception perhaps as often as I did. I typically in my writing will only talk about the moment of fertilization because even aside from what you just referred to, there's a lot of fuzziness about what conception means. The dictionary definition even goes so far as to say it's the state of pregnancy. Well, pregnancy doesn't really technically take place until after implantation. So, yeah, it's a fuzzy area, so I prefer only to talk about fertilization. Yeah?
I don't want to put words in your mouth or Sarah's mouth, but would both of you agree with terms similar to graduated ensoulment?
Again, my model's hesitant enough that I'm not fully committed, but I think I favor something like that, an idea that it develops over time.
I took an epigenetic view of soul and body functioning together. So
we'll go down to the front row and then the second row here. Yeah.
In Leviticus, I think 17, it defines life as in the blood. And blood doesn't form until about the second week. And that's about at the same time that you get the formation of identical twins also.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting observation.
Something to look at there.
Yeah. In some sense, that's a pre-scientific notion, so I'm not going to put too much stock on it, but that certainly has some significance, I'm sure. Yeah?
I mean, sort of the same question, Sarah. I just don't understand how your definition of personhood can include the severely mentally disabled.
Well, again, for me, it's God's intention. And that, to me, is even stronger. Because, you know, you can argue that this embryo is maybe even a defective embryo. So in the case of in vitro fertilization, pre-genetic diagnosis, you can say, okay, this is a defective embryo. Maybe this embryo is going to develop anencephaly, and we don't have the test for that yet, but we will, I'm sure, someday. Let's just discard it. No. I'm not saying anything about the importance of consciousness per se. I'm saying that that God's intention for that embryo. I can see where you can get that from. as a whole, the human species develops over time, and there are these landmarks. And so I think in generality, we're talking about the most common situation. But I think God has a good intention for that mentally defective individual or that mentally decrepit individual. Yeah, in the back.
Have either of you had any comments about in vitro fertilization and the consequent loss of these embryos?
This is exactly what got me so worked up about this a few years ago. I took a survey in my genetics class, informal. I said, how many of you would oppose abortion? Every hand in the class went up. I said, okay, good. How many of you would oppose in vitro fertilization as it's currently practiced today in the U.S.? And they looked around at each other. They looked at me. They wrinkled their forehead. Maybe one or two hands went up. And I said, how many of you would oppose embryonic stem cell therapy as it's intended to go forward? And most of the hands went up. And I said, okay, where's the disconnect? I'm not saying I favor embryonic stem cell therapy, but I'm saying if we vilify embryonic stem cell therapy, we have to take a close look at what's happening in vitro, the way it's going on today. Yeah. Well, yeah, one more question. This is later Bishop Ratzinger?
Yeah. Joseph Ratzinger.
What was the name again?
Introduction to the Christian State, 1968. If the soul, that soul is ensouled after a number of weeks or days or whatever, is not to be understood as the essence of the person itself, and we're to see the body as an integral part of the person, why should the absence of that particular type of soul in the early days of the gestation of a human person be of any consequence at all for the status of that human person?
I think if I understand your question, I think I would agree with you that ensoulment, in my view, is not a prerequisite for preserving sanctity of life.
And I wasn't arguing for abortion on demand or anything like that. What I'm saying is that the arguments we use against abortion need to be rethought and reformulated.
That may well be the case. I mean, certainly Catholics will very often say that the souls from the first moment of conception, that this is not the, for instance, so they make that part of our rationale very commonly, but in fact, we never actually held down exactly when that soul comes in, how it happens.
Yep. I'd be happy, and I don't know about Sarah, but I'd be happy to hang around and talk. Thanks so much for your attention, and have a great rest of the conference.